surprised you by coming out 3 minutes early. Are you all ready? Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. This is the third case we're hearing this afternoon, and we have another case that's being submitted without oral argument. Without further ado, let's proceed.
I'm a little nervous. This is the second time I've done oral argument, so I'm a lot nervous. This case involves a DWI that occurred back, was tried in July of 2013. McNeely was handed down April 17th of 2013. And in handling the case, the trial attorney for Mr. Bernal failed to recognize, address, or even mention the Bernal case. And from the transcript and record itself, it does appear failed to even know of the existence of the McNeely case at that time. Due to that fact, Mr. Bernal, whose case was almost exactly like McNeely, very, very close, should have had at least the opportunity to have that issue addressed, either prior to trial in a motion to suppress, or after trial began in some form or fashion. It should have been addressed. And just for the court's information, I'm sure you already know, I just found out this morning, the Dowd's case 5 days ago was finally accepted by the Court of Criminal Appeals dealing with McNeely and the transportation code. So hopefully there will be a resolution in the division between the courts of appeal that currently exist, with the majority following McNeely and holding that a warrantless search under 724.012B3B didn't allow or anything more essentially than suspension of your license, that it was not consent to have blood drawn without a warrant, absent exigent circumstances, of course. And since April 17th of 2013, as of today at 1:45, it has been cited across this country 489 times. Within 5 days, on April 22nd of 2013, 5 days after McNeely, in Minnesota, Brooks v. Minnesota, it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, who reversed it and remanded it to be reconsidered in light of McNeely. In Texas, it has been addressed repeatedly over the last 17 months. It's been cited 34 times in some form or fashion. In this case, yes, it was new developing law, but it was not unsettled law. At that point, it had not even been fully fleshed out, for the sake of a better word, but it was something that should have been acknowledged and addressed on behalf of Mr. Bernal. In this case, the failure to do so definitely caused egregious harm. I realize under Strickland, this is generally not where an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is addressed, but when it is so blatant and so obvious, and there is absolutely no trial strategy on the planet that could account for a DWI defense attorney not addressing it when this case was so similar. Now, there are two cases cited in Mr. Christian's brief, And, excuse me, the one in particular that's cited is Ex parte Davis. That case, unbelievably, states in here when they're talking about the failure to ask for a youthful court instruction for the jury when deciding life or death on a capital murder case, the court actually held that were we to have to reach that question, it actually says, in answering special issues was an error so serious that counsel was not functioning as the counsel, in quotes, guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. But, and they said, we might well conclude that the error in failing to object and to act upon this would actually be so serious. But they did not reach that issue. On the other case, on Vaughn versus State from 1996, I can distinguish that because there was no law. It wasn't unsettled. It wasn't there and missed. There wasn't any law at all. So I don't believe those two cases are applicable to the current case. In addition, I've researched McNeely completely, and it applied in this case. The failure to do so on its face is ineffective assistance at this appellate court level.
And McNeely was resolved the issue of whether the natural dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream was a per se exigent circumstance which justified a warrantless search. McNeely did not answer the question as to whether a mandatory blood draw, as allowed under the Texas Transportation Code, is unconstitutional, or it did not answer that question. It specifically referred to the Texas statute.
Correct.
So really, at 3 months post McNeely, the law was in Texas and is still in Texas unsettled. And there is case law that says to find that counsel is ineffective for not taking action that is considered unsettled is not, that doesn't meet the standard. So why, I guess I don't understand your argument. You agree the law was unsettled 3 months later, correct?
It was new and developing. That is correct. And as demonstrated over the last 17 months, it continued. People kept filing their appeals to where we are now.
Look at what's happened since the time that the trial counsel made their decision. So, okay, I understand what you're saying, and I understand how that's important to you, but let's look at the time that the trial counsel made their decision not to bring it up, or they didn't know about it, or, you know, we don't really know which one of those it was, because the trial counsel has yet to been given an opportunity to explain if they had some reason to do that, correct?
In this particular instance, to this court, no.
Or to any court.
Well, I guess it's in
this. No record before us.
That would be a correct response. There is no record of this at all. But I still contend and argue that given the McNeely decision, as happened since then and across the country, even in that small 3 month period, including a Texas case after McNeely came down in April 25th, that attorneys and courts were looking at it, addressing it, and filing appeals based upon it. And given, again, the facts of this case, no warrant, a refusal, a questionable, reasonable suspicion, there should have been a motion to suppress, at least an attempt. Would it have succeeded? I don't know. But you have to do what is best within the limits of the law. McNeely was there, it was available, It should have been utilized in this case. At least, would it have succeeded? I think it would have, given McNeely and what was happening. I think there's a respectably good chance it might have prevailed, but it was never given the opportunity.
Well, I haven't heard you distinguish those lines of cases that talk about unsettled does not impose a duty, which you are imposing here, that you had to do it. How do you distinguish those unsettled line of cases from what we have here?
Well, and again, the two cases that were cited, Vaughn and N. Ray Davis, I believe are different. They're flat different based upon no case law on the one, none, and on the second one, the court actually saying, were we to reach that issue, this outcome could have been different. And so I believe in that respect. Then we've got the other cases, Store versus State, that the failure to request a charge in mitigation and punishment on its face, there's no reasonable explanation. Wood v. State out of Houston, again, absolutely no reason for the trial attorney not to have objected to an improper conviction document used to enhance. And Menifee, the same, challenging a non-final conviction. That when, and then again in Andrews v. State in 2005, that these cases showed that when there is something out there, when there is a tool available to a defense attorney to help their client, they need to use it. And McNeely was everywhere after it came out. It was everywhere. There simply was no excuse to not know about it. There just isn't. And I believe on its face that is ineffective assistance. Mr. Bernal was not afforded his Sixth Amendment right to have every avenue vigorously attempted to defend him in his case. And again, I believe there, given these facts, there was at least a possibility it might have prevailed. He should have had the opportunity to try in this case.
But you are assuming trial counsel didn't know about McNeely. There's no evidence in the record that we can rely upon that trial counsel did not know, is there?
Not in the record, no.
That's all we can talk about.
Well, and again, I'm with you on that, but the complete failure of the absence of it in the transcript and in the record in and of itself could easily lead this court to believe she didn't know. She did not know. There would have been something mentioned. If nothing else, there were no exigent circumstances. She talked about that, but didn't do anything other than say, well, any reason you couldn't have gotten a warrant, how long does it take to get a warrant? She went into that part and then didn't go any further because that's all she knew to ask. That's my content.
That conclusion with you, you understand that?
But
I
mean, I'm just...
You wanted to do that on behalf of the defendant you were representing. Just
yes.
Conclusion.
In this particular case, I believe the absence of a record regarding McNeely does easily lead to the belief and the conclusion that she did not know about it. She had not read it, she was not aware of it, and didn't know she should file. I believe the absence shows that. So, that's my argument.
That was a good presentation for your first one, ma'am.
Second.
How do you show from at the time there was a reasonable probability that the result of the proceeding would have been different?
Given, in particular, the fact that on April 22nd, the U.S. Supreme Court accepted cert and reversed in Minnesota v. Brooks on a similar case and sent it back. That happened again. And over that 3 months, this law was everywhere.
But do you understand that that kind of reversal and remand is not to be taken, that the Supreme Court is saying there's anything wrong? They're simply reversing and remanding back to the appellate court to reconsider in light of an opinion they wrote? So you're asking us to once again jump to a conclusion that the Supreme Court found that in that Minnesota case there was some violation. They simply sent it back and said, reconsider it in light of McNeely.
Correct. And I concede that wholeheartedly. But in addressing your question, that's my understanding and my belief that as a DWI attorney, I am to remain current on law, especially big law. And that wasn't done here.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. There is one thing in preparing for oral argument after reading my brief that is mentioned in the state's brief, but I don't think is emphasized sufficiently. And I'd like to cite one case for the court and address that first. And that is, as a threshold matter, I believe the record is insufficient to support appellant's claims. And there's a case out of this court, Lopez versus State, 80 Southwest 3rd, 624 at 630, 2002, later affirmed by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. It says, and I'm quoting here, an allegation of ineffective assistance must be firmly founded in the record, and the record must affirmatively demonstrate the alleged ineffectiveness. And this court goes on to say, where the record is silent as to counsel's reasons for failing to object, the appellant fails to rebut the presumption that counsel acted reasonably. And in appellant's case, the record is silent on trial counsel's reasons for not objecting on both of the issues raised on appeal. And granted, direct appeal is a difficult vehicle to raise a claim for ineffective assistance of counsel, but there was a motion for new trial that was filed, and there was a hearing on that motion, but appellant did not raise ineffective assistance of counsel in that motion for new trial, did not develop any record before the trial court at that time. And, of course, this court didn't come up with this notion of the law. It's dictated by Strickland that we are to presume that trial counsel's actions were the result of sound trial strategy. And instead, appellant would have this court ignore Strickland and instead presume that the trial counsel's actions in this case were the result of ignorance or mistake. And so, as a threshold matter for both of these issues, I think that the record is insufficient. But moving to the McNeely claim, in appellant's brief, appellant spends a lot of time talking about how the United States Supreme Court decision in McNeely versus Missouri affects, and for the purposes here, I'm going to refer to it as the mandatory blood draw statute, but we all know what I'm talking about. That's the crux of the argument here. However, how McNeely ultimately affects the mandatory blood draw statute does not control the disposition of this appeal. And as an aside, I don't know how that's going to turn out. My understanding is, at least when I wrote the brief, that this court hasn't issued an opinion on the matter. The second court, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, has not. And at first, it looked like, if you look at the TDCAA website, it looked like that the courts were lining up in favor of the state, and it looks like that support is waning some. But that issue doesn't control this appeal. What is controlling here is whether or not the effect of McNeely on the Texas Transportation Code was settled at the time of appellant's trial. And that's because, and I've cited some cases, and the cases I cited in the brief are relatively old. They're from the early and mid-90s. The kind of the statement of the law is that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel may not be based on case law that was unsettled at the time of trial counsel's actions. This morning, I was looking at it to make sure that I wasn't missing anything. I found another case. It's an African name. I think it's Okonkwo versus State, but it's 398 Southwest 3rd, 689, Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. In a footnote, they cite these cases. It's note 17 in that case. But they cite these cases, and they restate this notion that we're not going to hold trial counsel ineffective for a failure to make an objection based on case law that was unsettled at the time of trial.
Unsettled meaning?
Meaning?
We could argue all over the board what that means. Definitive spotted dog white horse case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, or the majority of the courts of appeals, or what does that mean?
I think if it is, there is kind of a continuum, you know, that something might be mostly settled or completely up in the air. I think I would, in this case though, I don't know that I really have to answer exactly where unsettled becomes unsettled, because I think in this case it is completely up in the air. We have courts holding, I go through this in the brief, but in Houston, the first court of appeals has said that McNeely really doesn't have anything to do with the Texas mandatory blood draw statute. And then you have in Smith versus State, I have the Westlaw site, I believe in the brief, from Corpus Christi, they say the same thing. And then in Reeder versus State, I don't have a site for that opinion because I can't find it. I only can find it in the bowels of the internet, because the Texarkana Court of Appeals agreed with the first Court of Appeals and Corpus Christi and said, we don't need to worry about this McNeely thing. We've got this mandatory blood draw statute. And then both Corpus Christi and Reeder withdrew those opinions and issued different opinions. And so, you know, in appellant's brief, appellant presumes that trial counsel was incompetent and ignorant by failing to argue that McNeely rendered the Texas mandatory blood draw statute ineffectual. And in response, I ask this question. Were the justices of the First Court of Appeals and the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals and the Texarkana Court of Appeals ignorant and incompetent when they wrote opinions and signed their name to opinions holding that implied consent blood draws were effectively insulated from the effects of McNeely? And the answer to that question is no. They weren't. And trial counsel wasn't either. And judges and lawyers in the state of Texas up still today are working through how this opinion of McNeely affects Texas, the Texas Transportation Code, and this mandatory blood draw statute.
Am I correct that there are cases that regardless that the record hasn't been developed, that the things that a counsel does or does not do is on its face so erroneous that is ineffective, whether or not the reasons for it appear on the record? Isn't that not correct?
I came across those cases, yes, sir.
What possible reason could there be not to assert this in the event that it turns out that the Transportation Code is found to be unconstitutional?
Well, in response,
I'm assuming your response is going to be, well, that doesn't show a reasonable probability that the proceeding would be different. But other than that,
I would say that, but I would also say this. Many times when we're trying a case and the defense lawyer makes an objection, the prosecutor responds to that objection. I didn't try this case. It could be that the prosecutor could have developed other evidence that doesn't appear in the record that there were exigent circumstances, and we'll never know. And I'm not saying that that's true or not true, but that's the reason why the law is the way it is, in my opinion, that if we're going to present, we're going to say that trial counsel, there was no strategic reason, then there has to be some evidence that that's the case. And I don't know if you follow what I was saying, but it could be, for example, that evidence could have been developed that there were exigent circumstances here, and it just wasn't because everybody knew. I mean, I don't know. But I just don't think that this is one of those cases where we can just look at the record and decide that on its face there could be no strategic reason. The case that I read had to do with trial counsel filing an application for probation or probation from a jury in a case where, and deciding to go to the jury for punishment when he wasn't entitled to probation from the jury. I mean, it's hard to really, even if you were to have him testify, it's hard to come up with a reason. So there are those cases. I just don't think this is one that we can presume there's no sound trial strategy. And even if it is as appellant claims that Denise Perkins hadn't read the advance sheets or, you know, didn't know, I don't think that would be controlling either, because I think that the case law was just, it's still unsettled today on the effect of McNeely on the Texas mandatory blood draw statute. The first court of appeals is sticking by their guns, and I think that they may have granted a rehearing, but I mean that's the status of the law now. It's still unsettled. We don't know. If there had been an opinion out of this court stating, you know, a contrary position to the state, you know, that would be, I'd have a harder time there arguing that the law was unsettled when our court has told us what the law is, but there was no opinion. And as Justice Gabriel points out, all these cases that I've cited in my brief about what these other courts have held, I cite them to illustrate how people other than Denise Perkins may be unsettled as to what the effect of McNeely is. But we really look at this 3 or 4 months after the McNeely opinion before anything's written on it. And it's clear that the McNeely opinion did not address the Texas Transportation Code. I mean, it's a Missouri case. It's not a Texas case.
Well, I struggle with the whole idea that because the law's unsettled, I shouldn't try. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. It's unsettled, so I don't need to try and use it.
Well,
but if that's the law, that's the law. I just don't happen to agree with it.
Well, to be honest with you, when I got this case and I'm writing this appeal, I did not know what the law was on that issue. But I do think that the law is clear. I mean, it says what it says, and that and somebody smarter than me has balanced that out. That we're not going to, well, and you know, if you read Strickland, when you write these opinions, you kind of get confused over if you've read this in the Strickland case or you've read this in cases that are citing Strickland. But the verbiage from the case, and a little blurb I wrote for you, and I took this from one of the cases, you know, to find that appellant's trial counsel was ineffective for not making a McNeely objection only 3 or 4 months after the decision and before any Texas appellate court addressed the issue is to, quote, engage in the kind of hindsight examination that the court expressly disavowed. That's what the law is, and that's the decision that they made. And why the law is the way it is, I think that might be an interesting discussion, but I don't think it changes the fact that it's very settled, that that's what the law is about unsettled law, if that makes any sense. Just because I don't want to run out of time before I mention it, the second two issues in the appeal deal with no objection or requested instruction regarding the traffic stop. The law is clear on this issue, too, that trial counsel will not be held ineffective for failing to raise meritless objections. And I believe the record shows that Officer Wigington had 3 independent justifications for pulling the appellant over that night, and I think my brief fleshes that out pretty well. So do you guys have, I'm sorry, you guys, do the justices have any other questions about McNeely or the Strickland really anything? That's all I really have to present.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Court. I'd like to address Lopez that I believe you were involved in last year. I'm sorry, I can't remember which three justices wrote that. I believe Davis is distinguishable again. The allegations made of ineffective assistance were very general and very broad and weren't as case specific, such as McNeely. And I am not saying anyone is ignorant, and I'm not saying everyone is perfect. I most certainly am not even close. And if I screwed up, I screwed up. But I don't think Mr. Bernal should be made to suffer for that. If I drop the ball, I drop the ball. And that's what I represent happened here. And the four corners of the record itself illustrate that. And when Mr. Christian was up talking, he mentioned exigent circumstances. And if you'll check volume 3 of the transcript on page 170, you will see there wasn't any exigent circumstances. My client wasn't trying to run away or anything like that, was he? No, ma'am. But did you ask him if he wanted a breath test? It was broken. So he only had a blood test. He said no. So there were no exigent circumstances that were brought out by the police officer himself. You know, he was asked specifically, which brings me back to McNeely, that said, you've got to have something more. And she should have filed a motion to suppress.
The state wasn't claiming in this case that because of the natural dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream, you don't have to have an exigent circumstance. That wasn't their argument in this case. They were relying upon the mandatory blood draw. So that's what distinguishes this case from McNeely, does it not?
I respectfully disagree. And that's why there have been so many appeals. And you've got to go out there and try and file it and create the law as it's now standing, which is the Supreme Court said, here's the situation. Here's what we've got. But it said you need something more. And in this case, it's turning out that the transportation code isn't enough. And there are many court of appeals.
You said it's turning out. That's
correct.
The benefit of hindsight. Because here yes. We are a year and a half later, and the case law has developed some more. But we can't look at that in deciding whether she was ineffective on that date at that time.
I completely see what you're saying. I truly do. But I still state she should have filed it. And the fact that there has been a great deal since then, there was also a great deal between April 17th and July 8th, and enough that should have made her move forward with that motion. Just because I just respectfully disagree. I believe based on McNeely, it should have been filed, and there's absolutely zero legal trial strategy that would warrant the failure to do so. None. But she asked about exigent circumstances. So there are none, which brings us right back to the division between the Court of Appeals, which I understand is happening now, but on its face, she should have filed it based on McNeely, simply based on McNeely. The U.S. Supreme Court spoke, and she didn't hear it. And Mr. Bernal wasn't even afforded the opportunity to have this issue considered.
You know, I think the problem is this isn't a white horse case. Say it's a gray horse, and you go down this continuum of, well, now it's a speckled horse and a black horse case, and then you get cases that aren't even a horse. Well, where in this continuum of cases on point, not on point, do you say, well, this here is where she should have tried, because this case might at some point have been applicable? And that's if this was dead on point, that's one situation. But McNeely isn't dead on point. And so that's a real problem to me of saying she should have done something when you have this continuum of cases theoretically that could come up.
And I see what you're saying. I do. But if she had looked at the research at all and the case law at all over that three-month period, she would have realized, oh, my gosh, this is developing into something more, and filed. Even 2 weeks, even at trial, made the argument, said, McNeely complies here, guys. Please listen to me.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, your case is submitted. And the Second Court of Appeals is in recess.